This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast, New Books in Psychology, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Eugenio Duarte, your host, as well as a practicing psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist in Miami. Today, my guest is Rory Richard Grinker, and he's here today to speak with me about his new book, Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness, published in 2021 by Norton. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my guest. Richard Grinker is professor of anthropology and international affairs at George Washington University. He is author of several books, including Unstrange Minds, Remapping the World of Autism. He lives in Washington, D.C. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So you're an anthropologist. I mean, how did you get involved in studying matters of psychology and mental health?
Well, it's actually a very traditional area of focus for anthropologists to look at psychology to the extent that we're looking at how other people think and feel, whether it's through different language concepts, different types of experiences, different types of rituals and forms of child rearing. So psychology is not something that's foreign to anthropologists, but generally anthropologists haven't looked at mental illness until the past few decades. The literature had been pretty scarce on this, in part because anthropologists were interested in studying the fundamentals of human behavior rather than what happens when human behavior goes awry. People were studying what the norms are and what things are supposed to be and not what happens when things don't go as they're supposed to be. So as an anthropologist, I am part of a larger movement that started a long time ago, before, just as I was being trained as an anthropologist, to study variations in psychology and mental health across cultures.
So since we don't often have an anthropologist on our show, and many of our listeners may not know exactly what you do, what is a unique perspective that an anthropologist might bring to the matter of mental health and mental illness relative to that of a psychologist?
That's a great question. The perspective that an anthropologist brings is one of some kind of detachment in which you are looking at things from outside of your own culture. Now, that's only part of the process. And I'll tell you what the rest of it is in a second. What we do is we go to other societies, generally. Sometimes we study our own, but it's pretty hard to see things clearly in your own because you take it for granted. You're seeing everything every day. And so you can't really get the kind of objectivity that you can get when you go to another society. So I lived for 2 years in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I've done field work in South Korea and in India and in Namibia, South Africa. And part of the process of anthropology is to see things that perhaps other people can't see. It's sort of like the psychoanalyst who says to the patient, "Do you realize that you're doing this pattern of behavior?" And the patient says, "I had no idea, but you're right," because you're just living that life rather than analyzing it. And then the second part of anthropology is having been away, coming home, and seeing your own world in a new light. Not to be too mundane about it, but it's kind of like when you let's say you left Miami and you traveled to Paris, all of a sudden the cars would look really small and the streets would look narrow. And then when you came back to the United States, everything would look so big. Huge cars, huge people, huge streets. And so it is that sort of movement back and forth between the strange and the familiar. We want to make the strange familiar, and we want to make the familiar strange.
I mean, when you put it that way, it makes me think that perhaps you as an anthropologist are better positioned to psychoanalyze our mental health system than some of us inside the mental health system, especially in the Western world, are.
Well, as you know, we have what I think is a pretty good perspective to look at sort of the underlying structures and the rules and the patterns that we take for granted because we're living them. It's not to, you know, go too far off on a tangent, but to use another example, if I asked you if your first language was English, to tell me the grammatical rules of English, you probably would have a tough time telling me the grammatical rules. But if English was your second language, you'd probably be much more able to do so because you understand, you had to learn those underlying structures. So as an anthropologist, we say, okay, mental health in the United States, let's figure out how did we come to separate the mental from the non-mental? How did we come to talk about mental health or illness? How did the discipline of psychiatry develop? What were the underlying structures and the rules that helped this field or fields to develop and for us to conceive of people as having distinctly mental illnesses? To do that, you've got to go look at your own society almost as if it's a foreign culture.
Now, the title of your book is Nobody's Normal, which I think is a very powerful title and something that I relate to as well. And in the introduction of your book, you say, quote, normal is a damaging illusion, end quote. So I'm interested to know how it is that your travels and your exposure to different cultures led you to that conclusion about what normal is and what it isn't.
The more one looks at other cultures and even history, because history is like, you know, the past is another culture in a sense, like a foreign country, to use a trite phrase, the more one sees that what any society considers normal is not embedded in nature. It's not natural. Normal is what a society considers to be good or ideal. You could just take something like normal body mass. You know, what is normal body mass? Well, in every historical period, what is considered to be normal body mass changes. What is normal sexual behavior? That varies from culture to culture and historically. What is considered to be the normal family varies. And so normal is really a variant of the good, what a society values and considers to be good. And in the United States, the history of normality is tied up with an effort to enforce homogeneity, that there were norms that everybody should conform to, and we should all be like everybody else, the so-called age of conformity beginning in the 1950s. And the concept of normal was then used to criticize, to marginalize, to stigmatize people who didn't fit into that ideal. But it's always been an ideal. Anywhere you have a concept of normal in any society, in any language, it's something to aspire to rather than something that is real. And we should always remember that the concept of normal is very new, emerging in the 1940s and the 1950s. Before that, the word normal existed, but it was a mathematical average. Normal was average, even mediocre. You wouldn't want to be a normal person. That would mean you were average. But it's only in the 1950s that things change, where we decide that normal is an ideal to aspire to, and if you don't fit with that, you are somehow deficient. That's why it's a damaging illusion. And there's no such thing as, in reality, as abnormal or normal. Nobody inhabits either of those fictional lands, as I call it in the book.
So if normal is, if concepts of normal are moving targets that change with culture and with time, then why do we still use them as the basis for diagnosing people with any number of mental health conditions?
It's very hard to give up on the concepts that we've grown up with. We still use the neutral pronoun he to refer to, you know, some, if you went to the doctor, you know, you'd say, what did he say? Why did I assume that the doctor was a he? Or to assume that somebody who got married has married somebody of their opposite sex. We make these assumptions all the time, even though we know better, right? And so the word normal is something that we use every day without thinking. We also use other words without thinking that are things we should reflect on, like saying somebody's not all there, or they have a screw loose, or I was cracking up, or I was having a breakdown. These are phrases and words that we use, but if we stop a moment and say, wait a minute, where do they come from? We see, for example, with those words like breakdown and cracking up, that they reflect an underlying assumption that the mind is a coherent entity of parts, only fragilely held together, and that they can break up and split. Yet that doesn't conform to anything we actually know from neuroscience, you know, or genetics. It's not like you have this part, this part, this part, this part, and then they break away. The word schizophrenia is something that the, you know, most illustrious psychiatrists and neuroscientists use today. And yet, ask any of them if they really think that schizophrenia is a divided or split mind. We have to look at these things and question the way that our behavior and our language and our concepts reinforce older ideas that we might be better off getting rid of.
So I guess along with your critique of the current and the longstanding way of thinking about mental health and normalcy, in quotes, do you have in mind a better alternative, a better way that we ought to be thinking, a better way to think about mental illness? Should we even think in terms of mental illness at all?
I think concepts like wellness and well-being are particularly useful because they reflect the actual individual's assessment of how they're doing. I certainly don't mind the technical term of functional impairment that doctors use, because if your normal function is to sleep 9 hours a night and to eat 3 meals a day, and that has been disrupted, your typical function, that's an impairment in something. If you have some kind of condition that is preventing you from doing what you want to do, what you should do, that's where we can, I think, really appreciate these concepts of, you know, things like wellness and well-being, but also the spectrum. Spectrum is really key to this, because the spectrum lets us know that you're never this or that. You're not depressed or not depressed. These are concepts that we use to help us understand the way people are experiencing their lives at any particular moment. So, for example, I have anxiety because I'm human. If I did not have anxiety, I would not look both ways before I crossed the street. I wouldn't look out for pedestrians when I'm driving. I would probably have lots of accidents and hurt lots of people if I did not have anxiety, because that is something that all human beings have. But there can be a point where that anxiety kind of goes over the border to prohibit me from doing the things that I want to do that make me suffer, that make people around me suffer. And at that point, we then should be thinking in terms of illness or sickness or functional impairment. But it's not because suddenly I have this disease. It's because these qualities I have, which are common to all humans, is at a particular point on the spectrum where I need and deserve help.
So tell me if I'm understanding you right, but it sounds like you are suggesting quite a paradigm shift. One from judging or thinking in terms of mental illness, not in a way that's based on any kind of conceptions of normal or statistical norms, but rather one that's based in individual human suffering and values. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah. And I'm glad you used the word illness, because as anthropologists, we don't like to use the word disease so much, or sickness, or disorder. We like to talk about illness precisely because of the way you defined it. You defined it as the person's experience of suffering. That's illness. And that includes the way that person experiences the world. It includes that person's family life. That includes their social supports, the larger environment in which they live, the kind of healthcare they wish to receive, the kind of adaptations they make in their life around that form of suffering. When we hear words like for disorder, we hear, oh yeah, this assumption that somehow the mind is, there's an ordered mind and there's a disordered mind. When we hear the word disease in anthropology, we think more of the technician's lens, the person looking in the microscope and saying, I see this virus or I see this bacterium. But you can't see human experience in a microscope. You can't see how a person's experience with, say breast cancer affects their family life, their vision for the future, their children's lives, their work lives, all the complexities of that experience. None of that is in the microscope. And where anthropology helps us in the study of mental illness is that it trains our eye not on that, you know, technician's lens, but on the full experience of the human being. And that is something that requires that we see people within the complexity of their lives, including their cultures, including the processes that marginalize or stigmatize them, including the processes that make mental illness almost always a double illness, the illness itself and then society's negative judgment of it.
Now, speaking of cultures, one of the compelling aspects of the book is how much you detail the experiences that you had visiting all sorts of cultures in faraway places. Do you have an anecdote, or do you have any particularly memorable experience that really opened your eyes or really taught you something?
Well, let me give you one example from home first. It was when a freshman woman in my class said that the best day of her freshman year was when she was diagnosed with ADHD, because for the first time in her life, somebody saw that she wasn't lazy or didn't work hard enough, that she actually needed help. And this concept of ADHD helped her understand herself. And it also helped to drive a treatment that was helpful for her. And it was at that point that I kind of realized, you know, what was making her suffer was the fact that not really her ADHD. What was making her suffer was that her family kept saying, you're just lazy and don't work hard enough. It was the way in which they interpreted her suffering as somehow a problem in her, individual. And yet the story I tell is it was her family, you know, it was her environment that was contributing to her suffering. So now let's just take a long plane ride to Namibia, and we go to the hunter-gatherers who were living in the Kalahari Desert. And as I talk about this in Nobody's Normal, I met this man named Tomzo, who I write about, who clearly has schizophrenia, as we define schizophrenia. But the Juntwasi, the population in which he lives, that community doesn't have a word for schizophrenia. They have a word for kind of crazy. But you're only crazy if you're actually actively hallucinating or having delusions. And he was taking some medicines that were given to him by a Scandinavian non-governmental organization, and he wasn't hallucinating or having delusions. And so there was no word to define him at that point, because he was not experiencing symptoms. But then how do people explain those symptoms? In contrast to the parents of this freshman in college who said that there was something wrong in her, the Namibian said, the reason that Tomzo has these delusions and hallucinations is because a spirit settled in him as punishment for something that an ancestor did. In other words, it's not his fault. He's a victim. He should be given social supports and care. He's not a deficient human being. He is the victim of being possessed by this spirit. And whether you believe in spirits or not, you have to admit that the shifting of responsibility from the individual to something outside the individual is incredibly helpful in making sure that he's not stigmatized, that he's not seen as a bad person, and that he's not marked forever as a new kind of person, the schizophrenic or whatever that might be. Where one of the key insights that I found from all of my travels is that the more society takes the blame for an individual's suffering, the less that individual suffers and the less stigma that person has attached to that form of suffering.
Can you elaborate on that last point about what you mean by society taking the blame?
Yeah. Well, in the case of Namibia, yes, society is taking the blame. It's just not his fault. It's something that happened in our community, and there was a spirit. It's not in the individual. But to make it really clear, one only has to look at three really important points in Japanese history. Before the introduction of German and British psychiatric texts at the turn of the century, early 1900s, when someone was depressed or anxious or otherwise debilitated with some kind of mood issue, they were seen to be enduring hardship. And they were seen to be persevering in life or to be struggling with the difficulties that all human beings experience as they go through life. But once the British and the German texts come in about psychiatric disorders, then the Japanese started to see mental illnesses as problems in the individual rather than problems in life in general, something wrong with the brain. Wherever we see something wrong, you know, think about psychological problems as being totally brain-based. You know, we see a lot of stigma. And so whereas concepts of depression were used throughout the end of the 19th century in Japan, they stopped using them at the beginning of the 20th century because it had become stigmatizing. And that carried throughout the 20th century until the last couple of decades, in which the problems in Japan, the rat race to get into universities, the job competitiveness, the work hours, the inflation and the cost of things, aging in families where people had to take care of aging parents because they were living longer, has led to a refashioning of notions of depression and anxiety, mood disorders, so that it is now almost expected that somebody will have depression at some point because they're living in an environment or a society that stresses us out that much. And so what we see there is society is responsible for mental illness at the end of the 19th century. The brain having a dysfunction is responsible for mental illness in the early and mid 20th century. And then by the end of the 20th century, society again is responsible. And then the stigma of mental illness decreases because you are not deficient. You are not broken. You are somebody who is under great stress. And I think there's a lesson here for us around COVID, because COVID is a universal stressor. Everybody is affected by this pandemic. And so if you said to somebody before the pandemic, you know, I'm depressed or I'm anxious, whatever that might be, we might think that that was an aberration. Well, I wonder why that is. Why should that be? Do you need to get therapy? Are you weak or fragile? Are you immature? Is there some other way I can stigmatize you for your suffering? But under the pandemic, of course you're anxious. Of course you're depressed. It's expected. And actually, under moments of great crisis, even wars, we see a kind of broadening of expectation that being under emotional distress becomes not only expectable, but reasonable.
Now, in societies, present day or in the past, where mental suffering, emotional suffering has been conceived in this way, in other words, as a normal part of life, as a normal response to things that happen, is there also a different conception of treatment? Do they even think in terms of treatment for this kind of distress?
You have a particular example in mind?
Thinking about what you said regarding someone in Japan becoming depressed. If I follow you right, if they see it as something that's expectable and reasonable, and they think of it in terms of course you would feel this way given X, Y, or Z,
right,
then does that mean that their conception of what it means to heal from that or to deal with that, to put it in quotes, looks different? Is there less urgency to quote-unquote treat it?
Quite the opposite. There is less stigma about getting treatment.
Mm.
And so we can see this in the United States with the pandemic. I don't have figures to give you, but I would wager that if you were to talk to them, some of the major mental health delivery organizations in the United States during the pandemic, they would say that their therapeutic sessions have increased, that they have had a big uptake in the number of clients that they've had. So one of the problems of the stigma of mental illness is, and perhaps the biggest problem, is that stigma is a barrier to care. So when we see stigma decrease, when we see the shame and fear about mental illnesses decrease, we see increases in treatment. And this is one of the central issues in every society in the United States. In the world, not just the United States, which is that lack of treatment is really one of the major barriers to health. Mental illness is probably the largest global burden on the healthcare system, on family life, and unemployment. And in the stigma of mental illness tends to prevent people from getting that care. But sometimes little changes have big effects. I tell the story of changing the word schizophrenia in Japan to a word that was much less difficult or frightening. The word in schizophrenia really translated as sort of like a mind torn asunder. And then the advocacy groups, along with the Japanese equivalent of the American Psychiatric Association, decided to change the word to something that was pretty bland. And it probably would translate more as integration disorder. And once that happened, you saw a big increase in the number of people who sought treatment, who accepted treatment, who were diagnosed with this new term for schizophrenia. And so just changing the word, had a very, very positive impact. So normalizing, for lack of a better word, mental illness doesn't decrease treatment. It can increase treatment.
Now, do you think that there are things that those of us in the mental health field can do, should be doing, to help this along, to help normalize treatment, to normalize this kind of struggling? Another way to ask the question is, is there something that folks in the mental health field are doing inadvertently to increase or to perpetuate the stigma around seeking help?
Well, I'm not one to give clinical advice or to give advice to clinicians. I'm an anthropologist. But what I do say in the book is that if we understood the history of psychiatry and psychology, if we understood the history of mental health, we might not repeat some of the same mistakes in the past. We might not repeat some of the language that we use that has shamed people or marginalized people. We might not see mental illnesses as something distinctly individual. We might be less often to prone to see mental illnesses as strictly mental and rather than biological and mental. We might be less likely to see mental illnesses as the product of things that happened only after the birth of that sufferer and not something that happened to their parents or their grandparents. We might have a bigger picture of human experience. And so what, as an anthropologist, you know, I find most startling about American mental health care is that it's an individual in an office, not that individual and their world in the office.
Mm-hmm. You know, from the book, it seems that you believe that despite all the obstacles, we as a society are headed in a positive direction.
Definitely.
With regard to the way that we think about and treat people with mental illness. What have you observed that makes you feel optimistic?
Well, I spend a lot of time with 18 to 24-year-olds as a college professor. And, you know, you look at them and you say, okay, however they're thinking about the world, that's probably the future. And they are talking about disabilities, developmental disabilities, new ways of thinking about body mass, sexual identity, gender identity, all of these things in a way that is open rather than secretive. They're not whispering. The student who stands up, a good example, the student who stands up at the beginning of a lecture class with 300 people in the class and says, hey, everybody, I'm so-and-so. I have Tourette's disorder, and I might say things that startle you or surprise you or seem to come out of nowhere. Just want to let you know so you're not surprised. In other words, don't see me as weird. See me with this concept of Tourette's that you probably all learned, even though your parents didn't know it, but you do. Or the person who says to his fellow classmates, I'm autistic, which means I'm good at some things and not good at other things. Or I have challenges in this or that way. Or sometimes I don't look like I'm paying attention, but I am. I just have different eye contact. There is a kind of new dispensation or new approach to heterogeneity and to the idea that we are all on this spectrum and that we move along this spectrum, or to put, you know, you used the phrase moving targets earlier. And that's where I'm the most optimistic. That disclosure, that openness, secretiveness not only creates, you know, or is the product of, creates and is the product of shame, but secretiveness also takes away the opportunity for understanding and support. When my daughter graduated from high school, and my daughter has autism, she gave a speech. And as she started to give this speech, most of the students didn't know her in the audience. There were 3,000 people there. You could hear murmurs and whispers, which are, of course, the sounds of stigma. They didn't understand her unusual way of talking, this strange cadence on rhythm of her voice. And then very early in this short speech, she said, someone with autism like me. And immediately all those whispers and murmurs stopped. Why did they stop? Because what had been strange and enigmatic now became framed, or she framed it, within this concept of autism that everybody knew. So when you hide something, you give reason to wonder about it and to whisper about it and to have gossip and rumors about it. When you're open, when you take ownership and define for yourself and for others how you see yourself, that's empowering and liberating and destigmatizing.
You know, I appreciate you sharing that about your daughter, and I know that you address it in your writing. Did you go through your own journey with regards to how you handled and how you felt about your daughter's autism diagnosis?
I didn't go through a journey from the lack of stigma to from stigma to lack of stigma because I had a really weird life, which is that I was raised in a family of psychiatrists and psychoanalysts. My great-grandfather was a psychiatrist and practiced psychoanalysis in 1910. My grandfather was a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. My father was a psychoanalyst. My wife is a psychiatrist. I was raised to think that nobody's normal. So no, I didn't. I've always been open about mental illness and whether it's, you know, me or my family or my friends. So no, I didn't go through that. Actually, it was the opposite. I kind of had to really learn as I was a child why certain things were stigmatized and why they weren't. Because, you know, clearly in my family, the way we talked, most mental illnesses, or at least the common mental illnesses, depression, anxiety, things like that, depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, were not in any way stigmatized. They were considered normal. But people still whisper that the single neighbor next door might be gay, or that so-and-so might have cancer, and cancer was talked about in a whisper. So I understood stigma. I just didn't understand it so much in relation to mental illness as a child.
You know, I'm going to tell you how I'm thinking about what you're saying, and you tell me what you think of this reading, but it seems to me like you were raised, fortunately, in an environment in which being quote unquote abnormal is normal, in which case abnormalcy sort of loses its meaning. And I see a similar thing happening in society now. You know, I too work with young people, college age students, and I've seen them doing this thing where they're now starting to use the language of quote unquote mental illness. They're starting to have conversations about, I think I might be borderline. I think I might have a personality disorder. I think I may be a little bit narcissistic, but they're not using it as a kind of self-incrimination. They're using it in a descriptive way and in an exploratory way. They're trying to understand their own difficulties and give it a name, and they find it very useful. So it's kind of like what you see oftentimes in society where a word or a concept that starts as a slur gets recuperated by the people to use against and refashioned.
And I'm all for that. I have to say, there are people who do not like the colloquial use of mental illness terms. Like, maybe I'm a little narcissistic, or maybe I'm a little OCD because I'm a neat freak. Because, you know, or I have PTSD from a, you know, a terrible class I took. You know, people object to that. They say, look, PTSD is a serious mental illness that can lead to suicide. Obsessive compulsive disorder is serious mental illness that can involve such functional impairment that, you know, you can't really operate in the world. But I actually support that colloquial usage of the terms because I think that it takes away their power to hurt. It takes away their power to marginalize. And it accepts that we are all on the spectrum. I don't think that when I have a student in my office that says they had PTSD from a terrible economics class, that they really think they had PTSD. This is what you were saying in your question. And I don't think that they are saying that with a lack of knowledge about the seriousness of PTSD in somebody who's experienced a, you know, horrible violent trauma or adverse childhood circumstances or war or famine or genocide. I think what they are doing, though, is they are accepting this new invitation to exist on a world in which everybody suffers. And that's going to make it less likely than that we will look at somebody who has PTSD in, you know, a clinical technical sense and see them as somehow a bad person.
You know, and I also see, in fact, in my own practice, cases where young people are using these terminologies, but, you know, they end up using them correctly. In other words, I've worked with people who have engaged in these kind of explorations with me, with their friends, with their family. I think I may have bipolar. I think I may have some trauma. And when you talk to them about it, they're often right. They're often right. But what I find is that it makes the conversation so much more liberating for both of us involved because we can speak more honestly. Are you finding a similar thing in your classes where people who really do may meet the criteria for these conditions are themselves able to be more open about it?
Yeah, I totally see that. And I think it's been particularly evident in autism, which has become such a common concept, and the term is expanded to include such a wide array of people that it almost doesn't, you know, whether one actually fulfills the criteria in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders for a particular condition, it's not, nor has it ever really been the key to better support and care and happiness. Doesn't matter if you fulfill every checkbox on the list, as long as that concept helps you in some way. No diagnostic term is good, or let me put it this way. The value of any diagnostic term is the benefit it provides. And who cares? I mean, if I were in your shoes, I would say, well, who cares if they actually fit every one of these criteria on this list of what should be in this disorder, as long as the concept of this disorder that we're using it for drives the most appropriate and helpful care. Right? Now, why should you be a slave to some set of criteria?
I was just going to ask if, given the trends that you're observing and in the direction in which things are going, do you think that we're headed towards a point in time when maybe we won't be using the DSM so much? Maybe we won't be thinking so much in terms of discrete conditions or mental illnesses?
Well, that's the move that the spectrum has led us to, away from the DSM's categorical view, older view of you either have something or you don't. But the DSM now has embraced the idea of the spectrum. DSM-5 has all kinds of stuff about the spectrum. It's a guide. It's a framework. And it is actually very useful for comparability across scientific studies. So if I'm doing research on a particular community that I'm a population in, say, you know, I'm in Istanbul and I'm studying eating anorexia nervosa, and you are studying anorexia nervosa in Miami, we want to know that we have similar populations that are in our study, and the DSM helps us standardize that so that those studies can then be comparable. But, Judy Rappaport put it best to me. She's the former head of child psychiatry at the National Institute of Mental Health. And she said, look, in my scientific practice, I am the most rigorous, I am the most rigorous diagnostician. And I'm not letting anybody into my protocols that doesn't fit exactly. But in my private practice, when I see a kid, I'll call the kid a zebra if it gets him into the classroom that's best for him. So there's a difference between how something gets used for therapy and help and how something gets used in terms of creating comparability across scientific studies.
You know, we're almost out of time. I want to remind our listeners that I am speaking to Rory Richard Grinker about his book, Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. Before we go, Richard, do you want to tell us about what you're working on these days or what you're up to?
Well, I'm on sabbatical right now, which is wonderful, which we, you know, obviously is in the word sabbatical, Sabbath, we get every seventh year as a professor. And there's a chapter in the book called the Dignity of Risk. And I'm working on expanding that chapter into a larger book length project, which explores how we have overprotected people with disabilities in pushing them to pursue their goals and their dreams by withholding them from them opportunities to fail or to take risks with the presumption that they won't succeed. Whereas the people who are not disabled or considered, typical, are encouraged to take risks and to fail. And so what I'm doing is profiling people who have been able to do things that everybody else wanted to prevent them from doing because of the disability. Because the denial of the right to take risks and the denial of the right to fail actually has been pretty dehumanizing. And I think that one of the things that most of the stories that I talk about, particularly around autism, have to do with in Nobody's Normal is that people succeed when they have failures. But we've denied that right to people with disabilities.
I'm so glad that you're exploring that topic. That sounds really compelling, like it would find applications really in so many situations. In other words, not just with the physically disabled but with lots of people who society deems non-functional or limited or incapable in some way. So I wonder if you would be open to coming back on the show when the book is out.
Absolutely. Love to.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Thank you for the book and for talking to me about it today.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I mean, I would just, I know that there may be listeners who have different abilities, and the book is available as an ebook and an audiobook as well, if people prefer that.
And where can people find you online if they want to follow your work?
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I have a website which has events on it that I've participated in, RoyRichardGrinker.com, my university, George Washington University. I'm out there.
Great. Well, thank you so much again, Richard.
Amazon. Yes.
Yes. Go on Amazon and get the book. Thank you so much, Richard.
All right. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.